From NPR News, this is Weekends and All Things Considered, a podcast that takes the best from Saturday's program, the best from Sunday's program, and wraps it into a tasty European Mother's Day pastry, or sort of. Anyway, this is Guy Raz, the host of the program on the weekends, and for the next, 30 minutes or so, we've got the former U.S. envoy to Pakistan who once told President Musharraf,
"Are you with us or are you against us?"
Also, a trial in Chicago that could, for the first time, reveal how much Pakistan's intelligence service, the ISI, was involved in those 2008 Mumbai bombings. And later, if your local public school was hard up for cash, would you bid on this?
Vasectomy for you and your cat.
Plus, Jodie Foster explains her weird new movie, The Beaver, and why she's got Mel Gibson's back, and the falsetto-singing soul man from Asheville, North Carolina, who went all medieval on his radio when a particular NPR host would come on the air. That's all in this episode of The Best of Weekends and All Things Considered.
Do you ever feel like a plastic bag drifting through the wind, wanting to start again? Do you ever feel this so paper thin? Like a house of cards, one blow from caving in. Do you ever feel already buried deep? 6 feet under screens, but no one seems to hear a thing. Do you know that there's still a chance for you? 'Cause there's a spark in you. You just gotta ignite the light and let it shine. Just
Wendy Chamberlain served as U.S. ambassador to Pakistan from 2001 to 2002, around the time of 9/11. It was a low point in the U.S.-Pakistani relationship, a point, she fears, we're about to revisit. I asked her if she had any doubts that some in Pakistan knew about bin Laden's whereabouts.
It's hard to believe that somebody didn't know. You know, the U.S.-Pakistan relationship is one of the most complex relationships that we have in the whole constellation of diplomatic relations.
And we're learning more about the complexity now.
We sure are. When it's good, it's very, very good. Mm. And when it's bad, it's really horrid. And it is simultaneously cooperative and beneficial to both of us and at the same time harmful to our interests.
Mm. Part of Pakistan works and cooperates with the U.S. military and intelligence community. Part of it undermines it. I don't know if that's overly simplistic, but what do you believe that Americans do not understand about, as I say, what appears to be duplicitous behavior by Pakistan?
Well, I think what we don't understand is it's not parts that work with us and parts that don't. It's the same part, and it operates simultaneously. For example, let's take the military. It provides intelligence. It provides counterterrorism cooperation. At the same time, the same army will support groups within Pakistan that we consider terrorist groups. So we have points where we wreak enormous cooperation from them, and at the same time, they operate against our interests.
Okay, but how do you explain that? I mean, when you were the ambassador in Pakistan and you asked officials, what were their answers?
I was there at a very special moment. When I arrived in Pakistan, I think, in August of 2001, about a month before September 11, it was perhaps the worst period in our relationship. Mm. Of course, a month later, I was sent in on September 13 to speak to then General Musharraf. And what I said was, are you with us or are you against us? Now, look, I know you're with us. It's in your interest. What can we do together? General Musharraf agreed to support us unstintingly in the fight against al-Qaeda and the search for Osama bin Laden. On our part, we lifted sanctions. We provided aid. Now, that was a point in history where we renegotiated our relationship. It's been 10 years. That relationship and the distrust has begun to build up again. Clearly, we don't feel that that has been an unstinting commitment to fight al-Qaeda. This makes this another point in history where we now need to sit down together, renegotiate our relationship so it's done on very clear lines.
Why, in your view, is it more beneficial to maintain an alliance or a relationship with Pakistan rather than just abandoning it?
Oh, I think it's extremely dangerous to U.S. long-term interests. This is an important relationship for both of us for a number of reasons. On our part, Pakistan is a nuclear-armed state, and we need it for successful efforts in Afghanistan. And we need to be successful in Afghanistan primarily for the stability of Pakistan.
It appears, if in fact it is true that the Pakistanis did not know about this bin Laden operation in advance, it appears as if the trust between the United States and Pakistan has essentially collapsed. How do you begin to rebuild that trust?
This is what I'd tell the Pakistanis. We're fighting a common enemy, Al-Qaeda. We would expect public statements from the military that debunk some of the wildest conspiracy theories that are put out there, such as all the terrorism problems in Pakistan are really the result of America's war on terror in Afghanistan. That's simply not true. And to debunk the conspiracy theory that there is an Indian-Israeli-American plot to destabilize Pakistan.
This is widely believed in Pakistan?
Widely believed, and although I can't prove it, many analysts say is actually encouraged by military elites in order to have an anti-American public so that it can come to us and say, you have to deal with us and only us because our people hate you so much.
It sounds like we're in a bit of a trap.
We're always in a trap. I mean, there's nothing ever easy about diplomacy, and that's why we deploy the very best Foreign Service officers abroad as we possibly can.
That's Wendy Chamberlain. She's the former ambassador to Pakistan and is now the president of the Middle East Institute here in Washington, D.C. Ambassador Chamberlain, thank you so much.
Thank you.
What did Pakistan know about Osama bin Laden's hiding place, and when did officials there know it? The U.S. is only starting to unravel that mystery, but another investigation into Pakistan's intelligence service is about to reach a critical moment in a federal court in Chicago. In the past 2 weeks, federal prosecutors have indicted four Pakistanis for the deaths of six Americans during the 2008 terrorist attacks in Mumbai, India. One of the men indicted is a suspected officer in Pakistan's intelligence agency, the ISI. Reporter Sebastian Rotella has been following the story for ProPublica, and he joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
You write that the first public airing of the ISI's alleged involvement in the Mumbai attack will begin on May 16th. What happens that day?
What happens that day is there's going to be a trial of a relatively minor figure and an alleged accomplice in the Mumbai attacks. But the star witness is David Coleman Headley, an American who has pleaded guilty, who did reconnaissance for the Mumbai attacks. And he's the one who has given enormous amounts of evidence that open a door into this underworld where the ISI is accused of working with the terrorist group Lashkar-e-Taiba and also to some extent with Al-Qaeda. Right now, the indictment accuses this suspected major, known only as Major Iqbal, but it doesn't mention the organization, the ISI. Hmm. But when this trial starts, we're going to see all the details that Headley has outlined at his length and that have been corroborated by other kinds of evidence, including intercepts and whatnot, that show the details of how the ISI was involved in the planning and execution of this attack, allegedly.
Sebastian, obviously the Pakistani government has not admitted any wrongdoing here. What are they saying about this alleged ISI officer, Major Iqbal?
Basically, the Pakistani government, at least in public, has denied that there was any role. You know, I mean, they've just taken the strongest possible defense, which is that there's any ISI role in these attacks at all or any ISI role in terrorism, which is becoming increasingly difficult to sustain. I think at least that's what sources are telling me, given some of the nature of the evidence that's coming out in this case and, frankly, in other cases as well.
I mean, for years we've heard about the ISI's role in fomenting terrorism and militancy in places like Kashmir and Afghanistan. And in India, Pakistan has always denied this. It seems that it has kind of become an unspoken truth. Is this the first time that evidence in a courtroom is coming out to corroborate that?
Yeah, I think that's what makes this case remarkable. It's like, as you say, many of us who followed this world have always heard about the double game, whether the Pakistani intelligence service supported certain militant groups or looked the other way. But that's a far cry from what's alleged in this case, which is that there was an almost symbiotic relationship between senior officers of the ISI and this terror group, Lashkar-e-Taiba, and that, again, they trained Headley. Headley was not only trained, allegedly, by Lashkar-e-Taiba, but he also was trained by the Pakistani intelligence service, which funded, paid at least $28,000 for him to go to Mumbai and spend 2 years doing sophisticated reconnaissance, which was key to this attack. So, yes, this is an American case with American indictments of a Pakistani intelligence officer. All that, as far as I know, is unprecedented.
Essentially saying that the ISI planned a big part of the 2008 Mumbai attacks.
Exactly. And what's important about that, too, is that even though they happened in Mumbai, one of the things that's clear, the attacks were designed, allegedly, by Lashkar and the ISI together with the explicit goal of killing Americans, Westerners, and Jews. Supposedly, Major Iqbal participated specifically in the decision to attack the Chabad house, the Jewish center, which he knew had an American rabbi. So that's what's important about this. It's not just general support of terrorism. It's participating in an al-Qaeda-style plot to kill Americans and other Westerners.
Federal prosecutors have indicted 4 Pakistanis. All of them, presumably, are in Pakistan, including Major Iqbal. Any chance that they will be extradited or they will ever come to trial in Chicago?
One of them is on trial. The Pakistanis has arrested him. The other 3 are thought to be at large and actively plotting other attacks. I think one thing that the U.S. government hopes is that perhaps it could put enough pressure on the Pakistani government to arrest and try them in Pakistan. But even that seems very difficult because you're talking about people, one of whom is definitely thought to be a major in the ISI, another of them who's a critical player in the attack, whose voice is caught on tape directing the slaughter in real time during 3 days, is thought to be perhaps a former military or ISI officer. There's just a feeling that these suspects know too much and that it's hard to imagine them being captured.
That's Sebastian Rotella. He's an investigative reporter for ProPublica. That's a nonprofit investigative news site. You can find his story, Pakistan and Mumbai, The Untold Story, at Amazon and at ProPublica.org. Sebastian, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Now, to a somewhat controversial way, parents and even teachers are trying to tackle the challenges of school budget cuts. The era of the humble bake sale is effectively over. Today, many schools are raising funds by mounting big money auctions, black tie events that in some districts can raise thousands, even hundreds of thousands of extra dollars, as our producer Lauren Silverman found out.
Let's everybody raise your bidder number so we can see them. You have a bidder number when you register.
At John Eaton Elementary, the school fundraiser has gotten a facelift. John Eaton Principal Jacqueline Gartrell describes the scene.
Lots and lots of very organized, beautiful tables where people can bid on items from a limo ride with the principal to pearl jewelry, trips to Mexico, all kinds of wonderful things. Something for everybody.
There's even a dental exam, Brazilian-style soccer lessons, and wine tasting in Virginia.
This is not your grandmother's bake sale anymore.
That's Daniel Dominich. He's the executive director of the American Association of School Administrators.
It's really reached a level of sophistication that was unprecedented in terms of fundraising. We now have many school systems around the country that have developed foundations. There is a national association for school foundations. And these foundations raise, in some cases, millions of dollars.
Between bites of bruschetta and chocolate-dipped strawberries, 2 moms at the auction stopped to chat with me.
How much planning did it require?
Hey! it's more than a big wedding. It's something I would never sign up for again. No.
But Karen Robinson-Obebo and Jackie Jones are willing to stay up late making catalogs and finding a jazz band because the extra money means their kids get a music teacher, an art teacher, and supplies.
Things for the bulletin boards or cotton balls and paper bags, and, you know, they're always needing stuff like that. And we recently got a new playground, so there were a lot of little things that needed to be added to the playground. So
across the country, in San Ramon, California, elementary school principal Sharon Keaton is wrapping up her 3rd auction of the year, and the stakes are high.
It's the librarian, all the art programs, all of the computer instruction and reading intervention, math intervention, additional help in the classroom from classroom aides. Those are all paid for by this fundraising.
These are professional operations. Auctioneer Lynn Zink has held almost 12 school auctions in the Mid-Atlantic area this season alone. She's sold parking spots for $9,000 a piece, a South African photo safari for $3,500, and tickets to the BET Awards with a walk on the red carpet for more than $3,000. And Zink says for an auctioneer, school benefits require a different approach than gallery auctions.
When I'm in the auction galleries, I'll be like, 20's bid, now 25, 25, and now 30, 30, get 30, now 35, 35, and now 40, 40, but get 40, 40, and now 45, 45, but get 45. We're moving along really quickly as we're selling items. But in a benefit auction, we're there to raise money. We want to be sure they understand what they're buying. We could be like, how about a $500 bid? But you get 500, now 600, 600 here, now 700. 600's a bid, asking 700.
But even hiring an auctioneer doesn't guarantee you'll rake in the big bucks. There's always the possibility that mom or dad's planned a play date or is just too exhausted to show up. That's where a website called Bidding for Good comes in. The site's kind of like an eBay for charities. It's run 3,800 auctions that have raised $45 million. Sharon Keaton, the principal back in California, has used the site for 3 years.
It's been very successful. The advantages to doing it online are that we actually extend our fundraising capabilities to a larger audience. People can send the link, for instance, to grandparents across the country.
And let hundreds of thousands of strangers get in on the bids. Plus, says Bidding for Good CEO John Carson, the money comes in big chunks when you're selling expensive wine tours and vacation stays in Hawaii.
Probably the strangest thing was the vasectomy for you and your cat. An unwashed Lance Armstrong jersey that went for $110,000. We just auctioned off a flight in Harrison Ford's biplane. It went for something like $55,000.
Online auctions are just one part of this new business of school fundraising. But like some of the other creative ways schools have found to raise money, think pizza ads on school buses or fast food sponsorships, these revamped auctions have their downsides. Here's Dan Dominich of the American Association of School Administrators.
Clearly what this does and will do is widen the gap between the haves and the have-nots. The schools that have the greatest needs today are your inner city schools, where the parents obviously don't have the means to fork over the dollars that they would wish they had in order to maintain a program.
School auctions raise another question.
Whose obligation is this? Doesn't the government have the responsibility, which they actually do, to provide the quality education that the community wants? Yet it's not happening.
So schools around the country are going to have to keep filling budget gaps by auctioning hot air balloon rides, puppies, and the occasional bike tour of France. Lauren Silverman, NPR News.
Many film reviewers have given mixed reviews, or even worse, to Jodie Foster's new movie. It's called The Beaver, and even she admits it's not an easy sell. For one thing, it stars her old friend Mel Gibson. He plays a depressed father named Walter Black. After he attempts suicide, Walter's saved by a hand puppet, a beaver puppet, who speaks in an English Cockney accent. And in this clip, Walter introduces the beaver to his wife Meredith, played by Jodie Foster.
Is this some kind of a joke?
No, hardly, love. Nothing funny about it.
Stop it with the puppet, right? I'm confused, Walter, and I need some answers right now.
Foster also directed the movie and financed a big part of it. It's the first time in 20 years she's put herself both behind and in front of the screen.
I had acted and directed before in my first film, Little Man Tate, and I swore I would never do it again. it's actually not terribly difficult to act and direct at the same time. It's just exhausting, and it does take some of the joy out of it. But this time around, I felt, especially when I brought Mel on, I felt that it was really important to ground the film in with a dramatic presence and to have somebody who had been the protagonist in a film before. I mean, somebody who was appropriate age and who I knew Mel would work well with, and he would believe that they'd been together forever. And so then I thought, why not? Why not me?
I understand that Steve Carell and even Jim Carrey were considered for the lead role for Walter, the role that Mel Gibson obviously plays in the film. These all seem like very different actors. First of all, why did you think that Mel Gibson was right for the part?
When I came on, Mel Gibson was my first choice. So Steve Carell and Jim Carrey, those ideas preceded me. But, you know, I really felt that Mel was the right one for this film for a number of reasons. The first is that he, on the one hand, is an extraordinary comedic presence, and he has a real light of touch. He's witty, and I knew he could handle that side of it. But the man that I know, that I've known for 15 years, is extremely complex, and he really understands struggle. I knew that he would be able to combine the two, the wittiness and the funniness, with this dark drama in a way that felt really absolutely authentic.
Obviously, a lot of attention to this film, a blessing and a curse, I suppose, is because of Mel Gibson, as you know, and you've right. talked about this. During the filming, of course, those taped messages to his former girlfriend came out. Many would call them racist, sexist, violent. They were released to the public. What kind of impact did that have on the morale of the crew, of the people and the actors working on the movie?
Well, those tapes were released after the film was finished. There was one moment of overlap when he was doing a reshoot on one day, the very first day that the tapes came out, and that was a sad day, a tough day. But he came in and sat down with no makeup on and did two of the most beautiful takes I've ever seen, which are both in the film. And, you know, I gave him a big kiss, and he got on a plane and left.
I mean, clearly he is troubled. He's a troubled person. I mean, there are things that he has said, and we all know what they are. Many folks in Hollywood, in your industry, have repudiated Mel Gibson, have sort of said, I'm not going to work with him. He has essentially become toxic in the eyes of many people that you know and also respect. I wonder how much sort of forgiveness you're willing to show him.
As far as I don't know, walking away from someone who's struggling. I mean, if you love somebody and you know them and they have proven themselves as a friend over and over again in your life, and there's somebody who's really a member of your family, when someone's struggling, you don't walk away from them. You stand by them. The Mel Gibson that I know, that I've experienced, is, and that I know intimately, and I think I can probably say you don't know, is an extraordinary man. And then no one can take that away.
Knowing what we all know now about about some of the things Mel Gibson has said in the past, would you still have cast him in the lead role?
Well, I'm so proud of his performance, and I could never look back and imagine anybody else. I'm grateful for the performance that he gave and for the partnership that I had on that set, and for, you know, the character that he came up with. That's entirely him. I'd love to tell you that I invented his character or that that I can take credit for his acting. I can't. I know how important a contribution an actor brings. So, no, I would never regret that. It's an interesting question. You know, can an audience, can you compartmentalize out what you may know about a star's private life through the airing of, you know, private moments? Can you separate that out from a performance? I don't know. Can you?
That's the actor and director Jodie Foster. Her new film, The Beaver, opened in select theaters this weekend. Jodie Foster, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is the music of a blue-eyed soul singer out of Asheville, North Carolina, who performs under the name Jari. And we came across his work in an unlikely way through his Twitter feed. Here's an example of what he's written.
People that I'd rather listen to hosting All Things Considered weekends instead of Guy Raz? Little Richard, Fran Drescher, Cyndi Lauper, Dick Cheney, Pepe Le Pew.
Okay, you get the idea. Jari is an NPR fanatic who, as you can tell, has pretty strong opinions about what we do.
Stephen Hawking, John Tesh.
Anyway, he also happens to be getting a lot of attention in North Carolina and Virginia, particularly for his live shows. Jari is actually named Jonathan Reed, and he joins me from the studios of WCQS in Asheville, North Carolina. John, I'm not sure if you're happy to be on our show or not, but welcome.
I'm extremely happy to be on your show, Guy. Thank you so much.
Before we lose this song that we're hearing, it's called Plot. I love this song. It was beautiful outside here in Washington earlier in the week, and I was walking down the street with this in my headphones, and it just matched everything I was looking at. Tell me about this track.
This track is actually a song that I wrote near the breakup that I was having with a girl from London that I had been having a long-distance relationship with. I had never heard the expression, I think I'm losing the plot here.
Oh, yes, right, of course, yeah.
And so kind of packed within the song are different British turns of phrase and also just kind of describing the feelings around the breakup I was going through.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was walking around this beautiful day thinking, hey, this is a great tune. It's a heartbreaking tune. Does this girlfriend in London, for ex-girlfriend in London, know that the song is about her?
I think she does. She kind of broke off contact with me. Right. So I don't know.
Well, maybe she's an NPR listener. I'm gonna get her to listen to the song.
Yeah.
did you send her the record?
I think I did, and I haven't heard back from her about it. So. Yeah, maybe this will reconnect us on a level of friendship.
Or maybe when you're playing stadiums, you can invite her to the show and give her box, you know, skybox seats or something.
Yeah, her and her new husband. That would be great.
John, I want to ask more about your music, obviously, but let's just get to the bottom of this Twitter business. Would you really rather listen to a radio show hosted by this woman?
You really do talk like that. Who would make this up?
Fran Drescher is very, very annoying. Would you rather listen to Fran Drescher?
I wouldn't. And I do have to say that your voice has really grown on me.
Oh, good.
I think
good.
It's, right. You know, change is difficult. And as I kind of said in the blog that I wrote about this whole thing, like I kind of grew up with Michelle Norris and Jackie Lydon and Robert Siegel and all these people. And it's, you know, change is difficult.
Oh, but yeah.
I was kind of blowing it out of proportion for comedic effect, for sure.
Even for us, by the way, I mean, these are all colleagues and friends and people that I grew up listening to, some of them.
Yeah.
I want to take a listen to another track off the new album, which is called Blood of the Summer, I should mention. This song is called So Inclined. When they're calling and I'm caving and I'm riding down, I want to sleep over. When I first heard this, I thought Chris Isaak and Burt Bacharach. There's this kind of melancholy to it. Are you sort of calling upon that singer-songwriter tradition from the 60s and the 70s on this record?
Oh, yeah. I would also throw in a little Michael McDonald as well. Yeah, definitely. I kind of long for the days when I would ride around in the station wagon with my parents and hear great songwriters on pop radio.
But I mean, that sound still does hold up.
Oh, yeah. I'd say so.
That's Jonathan Reed. He performs as Jari, and his latest record is called Blood of the Summer. It's available through iTunes. John, thanks so much. Thanks for being a good sport and coming on.
Thanks a lot, Guy. I really appreciate it.
And by the way, have I won you over? Are you okay with my voice now? Or at least
I really am. At first, it just started going to the background, and now, you know what? I've kind of embraced it.
Oh, shucks. All right, I guess it's appropriate to end with another track from your album. This one is called Amends. Won't lie, I'm in my head. Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends and All Things Considered. The program this week was directed by Phil Harrell and produced by Petra Mayer, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Megan Kane, Brent Bachman, and Jessica Diehl. Daniel Shukin is our technical director, Rick Holter is our senior editor, and our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next Sunday with the best of Weekends and All Things Considered. And remember, you can always hear the full version of this program on your local public radio station each Saturday and Sunday afternoon.